424-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Now, we weren't expecting much rain. We see a couple of showers popping up down around Cranberry, Zeeley, and Opa. They're getting a little bit right now, so we'll keep an eye on the radar for you. We have a great program today. A lot of guests. In just a minute or so, we're going to be talking with political polling analyst Doug Saltzman. He was at the congressional baseball game last night down in Washington, D.C. So we'll get a firsthand report on that. Quite a story there. In the wake of the shooting, of course, the day before. Also joining us on the program today, Jesuit priest James Martin. He's the editor-at-large of America Magazine. He's written extensively several books. He was also a frequent guest with Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report when Colbert was on Comedy Central. He'll be chatting with us about his new book entitled Building a Bridge. We're also going to be talking about Habitat for Humanity today. And it's Father's Day weekend, so we'll be chatting with Bob Dvorak, who is a war correspondent from the Persian Gulf War, 25 years ago now, 1990, 91, in that range. In his book that recounts his war experience as a war correspondent, he includes a chapter about his father, who was a Navy veteran in World War II. Pretty poignant stuff. Good to talk about on Father's Day weekend. So all of that coming up as we go through the program today. But as we mentioned, first of all, we're going to say hello to Doug Saltzman, who joins us on the telephone right now. Doug, good afternoon. Nice to have you with us today.
Good afternoon, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
I'm surprised that you're up and around already, to be honest with you. You were in Washington, D.C. last night for the congressional baseball game, and then you drove home in the middle of the night, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I did. I was glad it was a seven-inning game and not a nine-inning game, I have to tell you. I was pleased when they had when they sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the middle of the fourth. I'm like, oh, good, this may only be going to seven.
This was, it was a special poignancy about the game last night, of course, in the wake of the horrific shooting incident the day before. Is this something that you've gone to in the past, or did you decide you wanted to go because of the significance of this year, right after the shooting incident?
Well, I've gone to it quite a few times over the years, and I practiced with the congressman back when I was on Senator Spector's staff. They always said they needed a catcher. I'm not quite sure why they called me. I played some baseball in high school, but I never caught, but they just needed a catcher for practice, and I practiced on that very same field where the shooting took place the other day.
Wow.
And actually would visit friends of mine down here, and their son, they live in Alexandria, and their son plays baseball on that very same field. So, yeah, that really, it caught me. I haven't been to that game in some time, and when I've been to the game in the past, there were times when there may have been 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people there, not almost 25,000 like it were last night.
Hmm. Doug Saltzman was once the top administrative aide to the late Senator Arlen Specter in Washington, D.C., but it's only House members that play in this, right? Senators don't play.
The House and Senate, very few senators over the years actually played. Senator Paul, Rand Paul, played last night. He was at that field the day of the shooting, and he was the one that made the very strong comment, and he was absolutely right. If the Capitol Police hadn't been there, it would have been nothing short of a massacre. Now, all they had to protect themselves against a man with a repeating rifle were their baseball bats, and that's not going to do it.
I saw video of the shooting. I almost hate to describe it because it was horrific, but it was on one of the cable news channels a couple of nights ago. I'm not quite sure where they got the video, whether it was just happened to be someone who was there who turned on their cell phone or whatever, but it was right at the beginning, and they just let it play, Doug, and it was about 2.5-3 minutes. And initially, it was just this rapid firing. You could tell that it was a rifle. You could tell that it was an assault rifle. It was, you know, bang, 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 pause, bang, 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 bang. And then you could hear shouting by the Capitol Security Police. They didn't know where the guy was. You could hear him saying, "Where is he?" One guy yells, "I think he's behind home plate." Meanwhile, shootings going on, and you can see people lying out on the field. I'm assuming that it was Representative Scalise who was hit right away and was lying out near second base in the infield. And it just went on for about 3 minutes, just this shooting. And it was horrific. It was painful to watch, really.
I saw that same video, and I have to tell you, it was the worst thing I'd seen since I saw the Bud Dwyer suicide many, many years ago. Yeah. It churned up the same type of feeling. I guess, you know, as opposed to somebody, you know, in wartime who actually witnesses something like that almost on a regular basis when you served in combat. But that's the first thing I thought about. That was the worst thing I'd seen since Bud Dwyer.
And Paul Ryan is right, the Speaker. If the Capitol Police hadn't been there, and they were able to finally bring this guy down within about 3 minutes, but if they hadn't been there, it was like a shooting gallery. They didn't have any weapons, and this guy's, you know, outside the fence with a handgun and an assault rifle, just picking him off. It was horrendous, horrendous.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how they could have stopped him. It would have gone until police arrived, and how long would that have taken? You know, it's going to take at least 5-10 minutes for somebody to call, mm-hmm, if they're capable of doing it, and get the location. And, you know, I remember one time trying to describe, we needed an ambulance at a field for a child who got hurt during the game, and not one of us knew the address of the field. You know, you don't think of fields with addresses, and we're trying to describe where we were at this field, and that can be a tough thing under fire, literally under fire in this case.
Never thought about that. Well, a member of Congress from our area, Mike Doyle, he's a Democrat, who is the team manager of the Democrats, was also on TV the day of the shooting. And gosh, the name of the Republican manager is slipping my mind now.
Joe Barton, yes. Congressman from Texas.
Thank you. But a very somber joint press conference, but in a way reassuring. Did you see any video of that, Doug?
Oh, I sure did. I mean, I tell you, Mike Doyle, who I've known for many, many years, we were both staffers in Harrisburg at one time when I worked for Mike Fisher at the state senate level, in between stints with Arlen Specter. So I've known the congressman for many, many years, and boy, he stood tall through this whole thing. You wouldn't think you'd be in the national spotlight on a somber note when you're the captain of the Democratic baseball team in Congress, for heaven's sake. That's supposed to be nothing but good times and innocence. And is there anything more innocent than a bunch of old guys getting together playing baseball?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not supposed to turn into a situation like this. But in an odd way, it's brought the sides together. I don't know how long that will last. It's a tough place, and Congress is divided as it's ever been. But maybe they can learn from this. It would be a terrific thing. It really would.
Do you think that the media in any way play a part in the divisive nature of our American society these days? And I'm going to say specifically, first of all, the social media, because I tell you, I don't partake a lot of that, but when I do look at some of the stuff, it is scary. It is so negative. It is so ugly. I guess that's why I don't partake in it too much to begin with.
And in so many cases, Dave, it's so gutless, because people can hide behind it. They don't have to give out their name. They can bully kids in junior high and middle school. They can bully members of Congress, and they don't have to, you know, give their name if they don't want to. And mm-hmm. I find that so gutless and so cowardice. But I think the social media times can do that. And if Congress are tearing into each other, the media has the right to report on that. I think sometimes commentators in the media go a little too far at times, certainly, on both sides.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see them stand so tall last night.
What about, I'm trying to point the microscope my way, what about talk radio? And I speak not just locally, but nationally. Do you think that plays a part in the divisive nature of our society?
Well, I think at times if a host doesn't rein it in, you know, if they just let somebody drone on just vitriol for the purpose of droning on with vitriol, but you can have a decent discussion and allow that to happen. I mean, people know my background. I'm a Republican. I do political analysis, and I might be critical of someone, but I'm not vitriolic in that criticism. I state my opinion and try to back it up with facts that I know. But no, you can have a good discussion. I think back to the days, was anybody more different than Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan?
Oh, yeah.
And they would get together after hours and have a drink. And then during the day, they were as far left and as far right as you could be on issues, but they didn't hate each other. I think there's members of Congress that literally hate each other, and they're never going to say it publicly, but I think that's a shame. It goes back to a fictional character, Tom Hagen, in The Godfather, always telling Sonny, it's just business, it's not personal. And I think some members of Congress could take Tom Hagen's advice. And the consigliere knew what he was talking about. It's just business. It's not personal. And that's how they have to, I think, view it at times. And unfortunately, they don't.
I'm smiling because it's the first time I have heard that used as an analogy for our current state of affairs. But by gosh, it fits right in, Doug. It really does. Yeah.
It probably has something to do with the fact I think I've seen that movie 27 times. You know, it's one of those movies that, if it's on, if it comes on at midnight, you're like, oh, no, I got to shut this off. I'll be up to 3 a.m. watching this, even though I've got it on DVD, you know, under the TV. But no, that's good advice from a very fictional character, from a very violent family. Did not take things personal when it's a business situation. And Congress is a business. It's a business like any other business.
Have you had any update on the condition of Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who is the Republican House Whip?
The last I heard is that he's due to have another surgery, which I think will now be the fourth. You know, he got shot in the hip, but it's far more damage apparently than just on his hip. You know the organs you've got inside that part of your body, and a bullet like this apparently hit his hip bone and then shattered, and then caused a number of different internal issues, so I've heard. At last I knew, as of early this morning, he still wasn't out of the woods, and that's how they're describing it. And good heavens, you hope that he improves. Mike Doyle did a good thing last night. When Mike Doyle, the Democratic captain of the congressional baseball team, accepted the trophy, he then turned and presented it to his counterpart. We just talked about him, Joe Barton, the Republican captain, and said, hey, Joe, how about you put this in Steve Scalise's office? It can stay there until he's back on his feet, and then he can return it to us when he's back at work. So it's a small thing. It's baseball. It's not debating issues in Congress. But I thought it was a nice touch by Mike Doyle. He has stood so tall on this issue and really has served southwestern Pennsylvania well at a very trying time, and it's certainly not at a time where he had a lot of time to prepare. Suddenly, a captain of a congressional baseball team on every national news program. I'm sure he didn't expect that to come down the pike.
Well, let's hope that the general public, I include all of us, can take a cue from Mike Doyle and Joe Barton, and you know, even though we disagree, maybe disagree sharply, maybe diametrically opposed, at least be a little bit more civil in our discussion and our discourse. Doug, I was able to hook up with you at the very last minute, and I appreciate you making some time. I know it's a tough day for you, especially after being in D.C. late last night, but thanks for sharing your thoughts and being with us today. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, thanks for having me on, Dave. You have a good weekend.
And you too. Thanks. That's Doug Saltzman, political polling analyst, former top aide to the late Arlen Specter. He was at the game last night down at, National Stadium? Is that what it's called? Nat Stadium in D.C.? Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. We have a lot of guests today. And coming up, I'll tell you what, it's a guy that I've never chatted with him before, but I've seen him on TV a lot. I've read some of his stuff. He is Reverend James Martin, S.J. He's a Jesuit priest. And he's got a new book out, and we don't have a whole lot of time with him. He's a busy guy, but we're going to chat with him for a few minutes. Coming up next on the program, and then still later today, we'll be talking about Habitat for Humanity and a nice little chat that's appropriate for Father's Day weekend with Bob Dvorak, war correspondent, who has written about his father in World War II. Nice. That'll be coming, all of that coming up later on the program today, so please stick around. Up next, James Martin on the It's Your Turn program on WISR. That'll be right after these words. For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon. Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289. We are speaking today with physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist Dr. Edward Reedy from Tri Rivers Surgical. Dr. Reedy, what causes chronic neck pain?
Chronic neck pain is a very common disorder, and many studies, well over half the population will experience it at some point in their life. The most common cause far and away would be degenerative disease of the spine, which occurs in patients as early as in their 40s and 50s. Now, this is usually due to deterioration of the discs of the spine, which is essentially a form of arthritis. Other causes include disc herniations. Sometimes these are caused by auto accidents or lifting injuries or other trauma.
To learn more, call Tri Rivers Surgical at their new office near the Clearview Mall in Butler. Toll free, 866-874-7483. That number again is 866-874-7483. Listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, and if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey, special guest visiting with us. It's Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest who is well known to many of you, I should think, from his many TV appearances and his writings. He's written a new book called Building a Bridge, and we're going to talk to him about it. Father Martin, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
For you, those of you who don't know James Martin, he is a Jesuit priest. He is editor-at-large of America Magazine. He's written a number of bestsellers. He was appointed recently by Pope Francis as a consultant to the Secretariat of Communication for the Vatican. You may have seen him. He was semi-regular on the Colbert Report when Stephen Colbert was back on Comedy Central. So your new book, Building a Bridge, subtitle, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Your publisher, Harper, called this a revolutionary new book. Revolutionary? Is that right, Father Martin?
Well, you know, it's funny. I kind of objected to that language. We settled on groundbreaking for the back cover. That's their terminology. Well, I would say it's certainly doing something new, that's for sure. It's inviting the Catholic Church and the LGBT community into a closer relationship. And I think the other surprising thing is that it's doing it with the approval of my Jesuit superiors and the endorsement of two Catholic cardinals. So that's, you know, I think that's just as revolutionary or groundbreaking as what's inside the book.
It's my understanding that this book, the embryo for this book, grew out of a posting that you put up online right after the Orlando nightclub tragedy a year ago.
Well, that's right. I was, like everybody, appalled by the tragedy, which was the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. You know, 49 people were killed. But I was also really disappointed that more Catholic bishops, or rather only a few Catholic bishops, even expressed sympathy to the LGBT or gay community, and frankly, only a handful of them, really, you know, five or six, even used the words gay or LGBT. You know, I mean, I thought even in death, you know, these poor people are invisible. So I did a Facebook post that got around, and then subsequent to that, a group called New Ways Ministry asked me to receive an award. They minister to gay Catholics or LGBT Catholics. And I used the name of the award, which is the Bridge Building Award, as a kind of springboard to sketch out how the two groups could come closer together. Then that ended up as this book that we have now.
Have the two sides been in an us versus them relationship up to this point?
Yes, I think that's a fair way of looking at it. I think that the bishops, not all of them, and the institutional church more broadly, that would be the Vatican, the hierarchy, the bishops, priests, sisters and brothers, but also Catholic lay workers, you know, have in some cases made the LGBT Catholic feel unwelcome, excluded, or, you know, even insulted. And, you know, a lot of cases they fire people from their jobs. And so my contention is that that sort of focus on them is really done to no other group. I mean, they are really treated like pariahs or almost lepers in the church. And so what I was calling for was just, you know, welcome, really kind of encountering them and, as Pope Francis said, and just listening to them and just trying to be gracious to them and friendly and loving like we're supposed to be in the church.
How do you suggest in your book, Building a Bridge, that we might begin changing the tone of the relationship?
Well, by using something that's already in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is the virtues of respect, compassion, and sensitivity. And I think those three words, which I try to unpack in the book, really can kind of help us forward. I think also from the point of view of the LGBT community, they, you know, obviously have to also treat the hierarchy with respect, compassion, and sensitivity, even though that's hard for people who feel like they've been beaten down. But really the onus is on the institutional church to, you know, first of all, listen to them, you know, treat them as human beings, treat them with dignity, and, you know, listen to them. They're Catholics, after all. I mean, they've been baptized, and they're just as much a part of the church as, you know, Pope Francis or their local bishop or me.
Biblical passages that you have selected throughout your book. By the way, folks, this is not a huge tome. This is not War and Peace. It's 140 pages, something like that. So some folks are turned off when they see a book that's 400 or 500 pages and don't even pick it up. But you have selected biblical passages which have proven helpful for LGBT Catholics. Can you talk about one or two of those that you mentioned?
Sure. Only half of the book is this kind of invitation to dialogue. The second half is really an invitation to prayer. And as you say, I select certain Bible passages from the Old and New Testaments that I think are helpful, that have proven helpful to people in my experience, LGBT Catholics who are struggling. You know, one of them, for example, is the story of Zacchaeus from the Gospel of Luke. Zacchaeus is a tax collector, a short man, as he's described, who scurries up a tree to see Jesus as he's passing through Jericho. And, you know, the tax collector, chief tax collector in the area, would have been seen as the chief sinner in the area. And rather than castigating him and saying how sinful he is, Jesus says, hey, come down from the tree. I'd like to come to your house and spend some time with you. So it's a real public sign of welcome. And it's a sign that, you know, we need to treat people first with welcome and compassion, you know, before anything else, you know, rather than saying you're a sinful person. And, you know, not to say that LGBT people are in themselves sinful, but that's the way the church has often been treating them. And the second story I really like, there are many stories in the gospel, in the book that I use, is the story of the Roman centurion in Matthew, I believe, where the Roman centurion comes up to Jesus and asks for healing for his servant. And, you know, again, Jesus doesn't say, hey, you pagan, you know, you terrible Roman centurion who's a pagan, you're not Jewish. No, he says, you know, the Roman centurion said, you don't even have to come in my house. I know that you can heal this guy from afar. And Jesus praises his faith and then heals the man's servant. So, you know, I invite people to pray about them in their own way and think about, I offer reflection questions and meditations. But, you know, to say that, you know, the way that Jesus approaches people on the margins is with welcome. And, you know, it's community first for Jesus. Welcome to the community. And I think that's one, you know, that holds some lessons for us as Catholics.
Do you think the hierarchy of the church, speaking with their, you know, speaking from not necessarily ex-cathedra, but from on high, have hurt the relationship or the tone of the relationship between the two groups?
Well, I would say some have. You know, there have been really some hurtful comments. I think mainly, though, the people I speak to who are LGBT are responding more to kind of local priests, you know, that they've heard say things in the pulpit or in person and feeling unwelcome in their parishes. So there is some truth to the fact that some things that have come from the Vatican have been hurtful to people, but I think just as often it's on the local level as well. So I think the church needs to kind of look at its outreach, you know, from a universal level and from a local level as well.
One statement that you made in your book caught my eye, and you were talking about the hierarchy. And, saying that they're not the only group that speaks with authority. Authority resides in holiness as well. And then you mentioned a couple of people who are not members of the hierarchy. Teresa of Calcutta, Dorothy Day, an American, by the way, I think from New Jersey or in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They speak.
Yeah,
with,
sure.
They speak with authority as well.
Of course. I mean, you know, if Mother Teresa comes and says, I'm just going to make something up, if she were still alive today and she said, I think that anyone that doesn't welcome refugees is fill in the blank, right? People would listen to that, you know, because it's Mother Teresa talking. It's a living saint. And, you know, I think Pope Francis has that kind of moral authority today. But, you know, there are Catholics who are not members of the hierarchy who also speak. And it's a reminder in Catholic theology that the Holy Spirit works through all sorts of people. So, you know, people like Mother Teresa, who's, you know, not a member of the hierarchy per se. But also it's important to know that the Holy Spirit is working through LGBT Catholics. You know, that they are vessels of the Spirit as well, you know, as much as any Catholic. And we need to listen to their experiences. You know, how do they experience God? You know, what's their experience of church like? How have they suffered? You know, what is their experience of life like? And so, you know, one of the first steps to take is just to listen to them, and the church hasn't done a very good job of that, in my opinion.
You mentioned Pope Francis. He not too long ago issued a paper, an exhortation on family life, entitled "The Joy of Love." And you mentioned in your book, "Building a Bridge," that you were a little disappointed in the reaction by some in the LGBT community to the Pope's message.
Well, right. You know, there was a great line in there where he said something like, before all else, we need to remind the homosexual person, I think he calls them, of their inherent dignity. And, you know, every sign of unjust discrimination must be avoided. And, you know, I think people in the West said, well, that's not enough. But it's a very important thing to remember that the Pope speaks to the whole church. And so something, while that may seem sort of bland in the United States, or at least in some parts of the United States, if you think about how it's going to be received in, say, sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, right, or Southeast Asia, I mean, that's a huge statement, you know, where you have some church leaders who don't even want to talk about gay people. So it's important to remember that when the Pope is speaking, he's speaking to the whole church, and he needs to sort of balance things between justice and fidelity, between this desire to sort of speak out and also to kind of, you know, keep the church together.
Do you think people identified as gay 2,000 years ago?
Well, I think we know they didn't identify as gay 2,000 years ago. I think there was, you know, probably some homosexual activity. I mean, it's talked about in the Bible and talked about in the Old and New Testaments. From what I understand, I don't think that social construct really existed.
Yes, yes.
And certainly, we didn't understand it. We didn't understand the phenomenon of homosexuality sort of biologically, physiologically, emotionally, psychologically like we do today. We certainly, you know, have made vast advances in, you know, in the last 2,000 years, certainly.
And even some of those advances very, very recently.
Right. I think that's right. And I think one of the things that surprises me about this kind of ministry is that it's not just to LGBT Catholics, it's to family and friends because, you know, as you point out, you know, more and more people are coming out, as the expression goes. And that means that this phenomenon impacts more and more people and more Catholics. And so it's a book written not just for this sort of narrow swath of the church, but really for a large group of people.
Should we summarize your book by those three words that you used earlier in our conversation, the three criteria that you say are at the heart of Christian ministry with regard to LGBT?
I would be happy if my book were summarized like that. I think that if both sides or both groups and all of us could enter into a relationship of respect, compassion and sensitivity, we'd all be, you know, much better off. And I think that's the kind of first baby steps in this relationship.
You entered the Jesuits in 1988, correct?
I did, yes, many years ago.
Prior to that, you graduated from the Wharton School of Business. Heck, that's in Pennsylvania, other end of the state from us, but that's at Penn, right? Yeah.
I know. Yes, I'm a proud Pennsylvanian, I must say.
And you worked for General Electric for 6 years before you entered the Jesuits.
I did. I was at GE in New York City and GE Capital in Stamford, Connecticut, and was kind of finding myself more and more uncomfortable and unhappy, and then stumbled upon the Jesuits and, you know, as we say in GE, you know, saw the light. and, you know, change things around.
Can you take a couple of seconds, and for listeners who aren't familiar, you know, what's a Jesuit? Founded by St. Ignatius, I believe, of Loyola?
Correct. We're a Catholic religious order of men founded by St. Ignatius Loyola in 1540. We live vows like other Catholic religious orders of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Our most famous member is Pope Francis, and we're probably best known in the United States, although we do many, many different kinds of ministries for education. So all the big schools like, you know, Boston College, Fordham University, Georgetown, any school named Loyola, as well as high schools, and certainly, you know, closer to you, Wheeling Jesuit University, you know, St. Joe's University in Philadelphia. So we're known mostly as educators, but we're really all over the world doing, you know, pretty much anything that God seems to want us to do.
And so many of those schools have great basketball programs. I wonder if St. Ignatius was any good at round ball.
Well, that's right, especially Gonzaga, you know, out in Washington. It is funny, people say that St. Ignatius and basketball, and Xavier, too, must have, you know, had some sort of, like, maybe he made a deal with God.
I'm sure you've picked up, listeners, and our time has expired here to talk with James Martin, but you've picked up that there's a lot of humor in with his message, and you can get that even from the title of some of his books. One that sits on my bookshelf is called The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. And then there's another one called Between Heaven and Mirth. Father James Martin, S.J., thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
His new book, Building a Bridge. Thanks again. Father James Martin, he's quite a guy. I've seen him on TV a lot. First time I ever had a chance to talk with him. We have much more to come on the It's Your Turn program today. We're going to be talking about Habitat for Humanity. Judy Karakovich is going to be joining us. And still later on the program, I think a very appropriate conversation as we head into Father's Day weekend, Bob Dvorak, war correspondent, joins us. He was a war correspondent with the 82nd Airborne in the Desert Storm. And he's written about that, and part of his book is about his dad. His father was in the Navy in the Pacific in World War II. Yeah, kind of nice to reflect on as we head into Father's Day. All of that's still to come on It's Your Turn, so please stick with us. We'll be back to talk with Judy in just a couple of minutes. Be right back. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
I was just 49 when I started getting mail from AARP. AARP? Shoot, I was just getting started in life. Then I hit my 60s and retirement was on my mind. The big question was, did I prepare? What about healthcare? Are my finances in order? Not just for my wife and me, but for the kids and grandkids. I got the answers I needed from attorney Michael Pater, specializing in elder law, long-term care, Medicaid, and wills and estate planning, is attorney Michael Pater in the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center. Phone 287-7724.
Welcome, folks. Just saying hello to our next guest who joins us here in the studio. We're going to get an update on Habitat for Humanity. Judy Karakovich is here. Judy, nice to have you here today, for goodness sakes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And I must apologize because I was slightly mispronouncing your name in all of the promotional announcements that I've given over the past couple of days that you were going to be visiting with us today.
Well, you're not the first. However, if you live anywhere around Zillion, Opal Cranberry, or Harmony, I've been teaching preschool there for 30-some years, and so everybody knows Mrs. Karakovich.
I had the accent on the wrong syllable, so I apologize for
that.
That's
okay.
And probably all the folks down in Zillion, Opal, and Harmony were laughing at me when I was mispronouncing
your
name.
That's not right.
So what's your connection, Judy, with Habitat for Humanity?
Well, right now I'm the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
I started the Southwest Butler chapter of Habitat for Humanity, Butler County, back in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Butler was really growing, and they were looking to build more houses and felt that their group in Butler could only do justice to so many. So they came our way and asked if there was a group that would like to get involved and start to build down just in the southwest part of Butler County, which would have been Cranberry, Soyanopo, Harmony, Portersville, Prospect, in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So we agreed to give it a try. And then about 2 years ago, the Butler group was having difficulties and decided to disband. And at that time, the International came to our group and said, would you be willing to take over the entire Butler County area and become Habitat for Humanity of Butler County? And so our group was fairly small, and we really had to pray and think about it for quite a while, because we knew not only were we going to keep our families together, but we were picking up 11 families of from the Butler area and the homes that they had built up here.
Mm-hmm.
So
Big step.
It was a very big step, and one that you just don't take lightly or make overnight. So we had the International come up, and we talked to them about it. And their take on it was, if you don't take over the entire Butler County and absorb these other families, then their mortgages would get turned over to a regular mortgage company. And so then we really discussed it more, prayed about it more, and said, you know, we really don't want to do that to these families. They've been very gracious, very helpful, put in their time, done all their sweat equity hours, have become great homeowners. So we will give it a try and see if we can become Habitat for Humanity of Butler County.
And how long ago did this happen?
This is about 2 years now.
Well, pretty recently then, huh?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. We're really just getting into the swing of things as to encompassing the whole Butler County area. At first, we weren't sure, you know, if we could handle it. And then, so we spent the first year just reorganizing, introducing ourselves to the families, trying to get back on track with the International and get everything set up. Because there's a lot of paperwork involved, a lot of time involved. And then about a year ago, we said, okay, we think we're ready to take on another family as far as building a home. So
I knew that Habitat for Humanity was national. I didn't realize that it was international. It's many
absolutely.
Other countries. Huh?
Yes, all over the world. Started first toward the Central American, South American countries, a lot in Nicaragua and places like that, Haiti,
mm-hmm.
and then moved international overseas to countries over there. So I don't think there's many countries left that don't have a branch of Habitat for Humanity working somewhere.
So it started, it would be accurate to say it started in poorer countries, in some cases third world countries?
Yes, very much so, very much so. And a whole different thing as far as building. Here we do, you know, wood, brick, things like that. But when you were in third world countries such as Nicaragua, you're talking all cement block buildings, or even some places where they built them out of clay that they've hardened up.
Hmm.
So you work with the materials that are native to that area. Otherwise, you'd be too expensive to import.
So I'm just going to ask, is it there's not enough wood in some places, so yeah, that's why you use cement block?
Correct. There's a lot of areas where you would find very little wood that would be used. And in a lot of areas, there may have been wood to be used, but because in third world countries, a lot of times that is their way to, you know, cook. So the wood is more important for the fire to cook the food to keep, you know, a little bit in your belly than it is to build your house out of. So they were building it out of a corrugated steel, you know, like I said, just mud and, or stone or block or something like that.
A block would perhaps be even more efficient, given that there might not be a lot of money for regular maintenance and so on. And wood, if it's not maintained, painted every few years, especially in rainy countries, it's going to deteriorate pretty quickly. So,
correct. And so, therefore, you want something that's going to last 30, 40, 50 years.
I want to make sure that all of us, and me and all of our listeners, are on the same page in terms of understanding just what Habitat for Humanity does. Now, I would bet we could take our microphones right out on the street here and stop the first 15 cars that went by and, you know, we'd say, have you ever heard of Habitat for Humanity? Oh, yes, yes, I've heard about that. Do you know what they do? Well, no.
Mm-hmm.
They build houses? I think perhaps that a lot of us don't have a real clear understanding of the whole process. For example, you mentioned earlier, I took a note, you probably mm-hmm. saw me. Obviously, part of the process is holding mortgages for people, which
correct.
I didn't realize. I dare say, Judy, that for many of us, the image that we have when we think of Habitat for Humanity is former President Jimmy Carter with a hammer in his hand, you know, helping to build a house in Georgia somewhere. And to be honest with you, I'm not even sure that's Habitat for Humanity. I know the former president mm-hmm. has been very active in helping the needy build homes, but I don't know whether that's Habitat for Humanity or not. Maybe it's just his church or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's a real grasp of everything that's involved, especially around here. Because in Butler County, you've got, I don't know, probably at least 25 homes now, probably, that have been built. Huh?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah? Yeah? Yes. Well, you're right. Jimmy Carter is part of Habitat for Humanity.
Okay.
That was his big passion. Mm-hmm. It was started in Georgia, but it was started by a man named Millard Fuller, and it happened in about 1976. So it's been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of building homes, which is what we do. Now, we don't build them all. Sometimes it's renovations. You can take an older house. If it's of a good structure, you may be able to renovate that. Our group even moved a house. So we've tried it all.
Mm.
A church down in Zoyanopol had a house that was very beautiful brick home, but they needed a parking lot instead. So they came to us and said, we'll give you the house, you just have to put it somewhere else. So we got a piece of property that was not too far away, because of course you don't want to be pulling a house miles down the road. So it was just a few blocks, and then I actually, at that time I was president, now I'm secretary, but contacted the people, and we actually moved the house, which requires a lot of work too, because now you've needed lots of permits to put it on the road, mm-hmm. have people there to raise all the wires so that you don't run into anything, get all the permission as you go down the street so you don't knock over mailboxes and move this house. But the
also
whole,
pretty expensive, too.
Absolutely, very uh-huh. expensive, uh-huh. yes. So the thing with Habitat is, first, you need a family that qualifies. And the family qualifies, there are certain guidelines. One of them is that you cannot get a regular conventional mortgage. You don't make enough money. However, as you said, and I said, you have to pay for this house.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have an income to be able to, you know, pay the mortgage payment.
That's otherwise probably the first and maybe the greatest misconception that a lot of
it
people
is.
Have. You
it
don't is. You don't hand people free houses.
No. No. The other misconception is that we design a house and the family moves in and, gee, this is great. No, you have to put in 350 sweat equity hours, which means you have to help build this house. Now, if you're physically able, you could actually get out and help with the painting and the nailing or whatever that happens to be. If you're not, then maybe you're going to be contacting people to get them to donate so that, you know, everything doesn't have to be bought. Because that's the other thing. We don't want the families to have a mortgage they can't afford. So the first thing we need to do is get as many things donated as possible. Then once we have all the donations in place, then the only thing that the family's going to pay for after the house is built is whatever we could not get donated and now we have to purchase. We do it regularly as a 30-year mortgage, but mm-hmm. we're the bank.
Okay.
So there's no interest, which makes a big difference in how much they could pay. And the other thing is that, of course, after we get the family and they qualify, then we have to find the property. And it has to come within our budget, so we're not topping off this mortgage with a major purchase price of the property. There are people who may donate it or they may give it at a discount. With the idea that part of it is a donation towards Habitat. And then the other thing is the donations from different people to build. Then comes the big part, which is all the volunteers we've got to get on Saturdays to get out and start building this house.
That was my next question. What do you do with the labor? Because building materials are one thing.
Yep.
Labor is another major expense if you're talking about construction these days.
It is. It is. So, as I said, we get lots of volunteers. Saturday is our big build day, so we're always looking for volunteers to come on a Saturday and help us out. There are some times when people can come during the week, and if our construction boss is available, then he will take them out on a weekday to get it done. At times, we've had groups that have come in the summer and done a whole week, which is really helped us mm-hmm. to, move the house along, too. So it's usually going to take us at least a year to a year and a half. Now, there are people who are just not volunteers as far as they know nothing about building and get involved. We have a lot of good people who are tradesmen who will volunteer their time to do things like our electrician is an electrician, but he does this in his off time and doesn't charge us. Mm. There are block layers that take a day off or a week off to come in and do it free of charge. Because some things, like your electrical and your plumbing, you really need somebody who knows what they're doing.
And
wouldn't
you
be
have
good.
To get that, you have to get that. That has to pass inspection, too.
Correct.
Some other stuff. I mean, I could help frame a house. I know quite a bit about woodworking and framing. I don't know the first thing about laying cement block. I couldn't do that if I sat here till next Friday. I wouldn't know how to lay block or, mm-hmm. Pour a footer or any of that sort of thing. So you need certain skills, but you have volunteers who don't necessarily have building skills.
That's mm-hmm. correct. That's correct.
That doesn't eliminate them from being a volunteer
for
Habitat.
No. We've got lots of what they call in the trades grunt work, where mm-hmm. you can be filling up buckets or you can be moving things around or you can be
carrying
holding something.
You could be carrying bricks in your hod.
Yeah. We can find a job for you. Let me tell you, skills is not, it's nice to have, but we won't turn you away if you don't have any skills. We'll try to give you a few skills maybe you can use on your own home.
I have some other questions. We do need to take a break here, though. And I want to, in case there are some people that have to leave us, especially people listening in the car,
mm-hmm.
And they might be interested in, being a volunteer or something, how do they contact you? Is there a phone number or a website? What do you do?
Yes, there is a website. There's also a phone number. The phone number is 724-452-7560, extension 16. And we have someone that will get back to you. It's all volunteers, so it may not be that day because there isn't always somebody to man the phone. But mm-hmm. there's an answering machine. Just leave a message. You can go on the website to Butler County Habitat for Humanity. And I think we're on Facebook. So if you Google us, you should be able to find us. And then
Butler County Habitat for Humanity.
Correct.
Excellent. We'll talk more with Judy Kirkovich here in just a moment. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR Friday edition. One of our sponsors on the program today is Miller's Shoes, our good friends at Miller's Shoes. And generations of folks around here have said that my good friends at Miller Shoes, it's true. They're like 125 years now on Main Street in downtown Butler. Think about that. Think about how far back that goes. It's astonishing. That's tradition. That means a lot. Now, of course, it's the Chiprian family. Many of you know them. Many of your parents knew them, or maybe your grandparents, too. They're your headquarters for SAS Comfort Shoes here in our area. I don't know whether you've ever tried the SAS Comfort Shoes. First of all, they're made in America, which not too many shoes are anymore. They are the most comfortable shoes you will ever put on. They're like bedroom slippers. They also make sandals for, well, right now, the summer season. And believe me, their sandals are just as comfortable as their shoes, and they're American-made as well. And it's not all the same thing. They have different styles, they have different colors, just like their shoes. Check it out, your local headquarters for SAS, America's Comfort Shoes and Sandals, Miller's Shoes. They've also got name-brand shoes. Oh, my. Trotters, Hush Puppies, athletic shoes. Got all the famous brands there. Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPec. All under one roof, right there, Miller's. Easy Spirit, Foam Treads, many other brands, too. And always lots of shoes that are on racks, too. They're on sale for easy browsing. Miller's, 215 South Main Street, downtown Butler. Miller's Shoes. We're chatting with Judy Kirkovich. She's the Secretary for Habitat for Humanity of Butler County. And we're just getting a little bit of an update here on Habitat. I haven't talked with Habitat folks for years and years, and that's my fault. I should keep more up to date on that. There's no government funding for Habitat for Humanity? You don't have any regular funding stream?
No. All of the money that comes in could be through, we get donations through churches, through different nonprofit organizations. The Cranberry mm-hmm. Women's Club is a great sponsor of ours. There are a lot of different foundations that help us out and may sponsor, like I can't think of her last name, and I apologize for that, lady here in Loretta Phillips.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And or just ordinary churches or individuals will send us money. And one of our biggest fundraisers a couple years ago was Laura Crago. Her father was from the Butler area. He was a contractor, and she wanted to raise money for us, so she rode her bicycle all the way across the country from Los Angeles to New York to raise money. So we've raised it in a lot of different ways. We go out. Our big fundraiser is a youth triathlon we hold every summer, which is coming up in August on the 20th. So we'll hope to get a lot of youth participants and raise money that way. We have gift wrapping that we do in the wintertime. We're always trying to come up with new ways to also fundraise and raise money, too. So mm-hmm. it takes a lot of individual people's organizations, small and big, to say that they want to back Habitat for Humanity.
Do you seek out families who may be eligible, or do they come to you for, like, consideration?
No, it's mainly families call, mm-hmm. say they would like to apply to be a family. Then there's a family selection committee. They send out an application. And then if they fill it out and qualify, then we get back to them, talk to them, and then explain how the sweat equity hours works and how they will have a mortgage and where it goes from there. And then we start looking for property and for funding. Well, we're always looking for funding. We just, you know, hold on to it until we find that family. But we've been very lucky in that there always seems to be somebody that qualifies to be a family. And usually that comes from something like this show, or maybe it comes from advertising in the newspaper, but we just don't really go out and look for them. Mm-hmm. We really think that people who are committed to want to be a lifetime family member of Habitat will put forth the effort to come to us.
If it's a family, let's say man and wife and one or two kids, whatever. Just a hypothetical example. Does everybody have to contribute to the sweat equity? Or is it, what's the deal on that? You need so many hours from the family that, okay, you realize you've got to help build this house now.
Right. And it's $350 for the family.
Okay.
So it can be anybody in the family who is capable or want to give time. Mm-hmm. Some families, I mean, you know, 350 hours sounds like a lot. But once you start building a house and you know it's going to take us a year and a half to build it, you can get those hours in without a lot of problems. And there have been families where it's been mom and dad who've put in most of the time. There have been families that have had older children that have helped. So it works always.
And the sweat equity philosophy, I'm assuming, I know the reason for this, it gives the people a stake in this house.
Absolutely.
They helped to build it. That gives them a much better incentive to maintain it properly, take care of it, not let it get run down, so on and so forth. Hey, I got a stake in this.
That's exactly it, because they are the homeowners. That once we build it and hand them those keys on that day of dedication, then that house is their responsibility from then on. And if they were there helping or even just watching, you know, sometimes it helps if you have a leaky faucet or something going on, they can say, well, that's something that I think I could take care of because I've already seen it done, I've helped do it, and so I can help to maintain my own house.
Do you ever have people that have been recipients of a house then come back and help later on volunteering to build another one or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We have some now who have had their house maybe 5 to 10 years, and they still come back on every new house and help out in some way. We have great families.
Right. Give me that phone number again for people to get in touch with you.
724-452-7560, extension 16.
And if you missed that, check online. Google.
That's right.
Google Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah, look for Habitat for Humanity of Butler County.
Have I covered most of the bases here?
I think so. I think our great thing right now is that we did get a family. And hopefully in July, we will be dedicating this house. It's up in Worth Township near Slippery Rock. It's almost completed.
Wonderful.
So it'll be great to have a house done, and then we're looking forward to starting the next one.
Starting another one, huh?
That's it.
Judy Kirkovich, she's secretary for Habitat for Humanity of Butler County. Great to have you here. And boy,
thank you.
I think I speak for all of our listeners when I say thanks. This is great stuff. Great stuff you're doing. Yeah.
Well, we couldn't do it without the community. We can't do it without the people who believe in us, and we can't do it without our volunteers that are willing to put in their time. Not only do our volunteers come to the site, but our board also meets once a month to, you know, kind of get everything together and figure out how we're going to do it.
Nice to have you here, Judy.
Thank you.
Yeah. More to come. We'll take a break. When we come back, going to be chatting with war correspondent Bob Dvorak. He's, by the way, a native of this area, western Pennsylvania. He's written about his experiences as a war correspondent in Desert Storm in the Middle East. It's quite a few years ago now. He also has a chapter on his dad, who was in the Navy in the Pacific Theater of World War II and had quite an experience there. Pretty appropriate to talk about that, I think. On Father's Day weekend, don't you? I think so. Bob Dvorak. He joins us next on It's Your Turn right after these words.
There are times in our lives when we just don't want to be alone. We just need somebody, somebody who listens, somebody who understands. This is particularly true when we lose a loved one, a person who means so much to us. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring, meticulously designed to help ease your emotional pain. Men and women are invited to attend, and yes, men are realizing it's okay to express their feelings in a small group. We have hundreds of sessions over the last 20 years. Have helped many hundreds of people cope with their feelings. We have 5 programs: a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a beloved pet, and individual sessions. They're conducted by our own trained bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller. Call us at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler, 287-3706, 724-287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home, the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome, listeners, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, Dave Malarkey is my name. If you're just joining us, we're pleased to be able to talk for a few minutes with, war correspondent, veteran, and author, Bob Dvorak. Bob, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Dave, great to be here. Of course, at my age and what I've been through, it's great to be anywhere.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. We want to talk about, you have a book entitled Drive On, The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. Bedouin Bob, was that your nickname?
That was a war name that was given to me by a major in the 82nd Airborne Division because I had adapted so well to living in the desert with the airborne infantry. Lived just like the grunts in the sand. So, yeah, that's me.
Well, I wanted to talk about you in general, about your book. Fascinating enough. But specifically, as we're at the time of the year where we celebrate Father's Day, one of the chapters in your book, Bob, you dedicate to the story of your dad. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, and, you know, hey, the book is really a journal of my war experiences in Desert Storm. And when I was sent to Saudi Arabia to cover the war, I interacted with all branches of the service, including the Navy. I did a carrier landing on the Saratoga, spent some time with the ships who were interdicting traffic, and it, you know, just triggered a flashback. And so, you know, my dad was in the Navy in World War II, and he kept a photo journal. I kept a written journal. He had a photo journal. And, you know, here's the youngest of nine children of Slovak immigrants who owned a farm in near Uniontown, not far from where you are, same kind of country. And he ends up, after Pearl Harbor, joining the Navy, leaving high school early, and fighting a war against the Japanese in the biggest ocean in the world. So, not only did he fight kamikazes on that journey across the Pacific, his last port of call was Hiroshima after they dropped the bomb. So, there was a city reduced to ashes by a single bomb. Something that maybe probably no 19-year-old kid should ever see.
Your dad, Uniontown native, that was also the home of one of the big guys, one of the top brass in World War II, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. George C. Marshall, the five-star general, who was the chief of staff and probably the most important military officer in World War II because, you know, he made the decisions that affected the fighting in Europe and in the Pacific. But I think it goes to show you, Dave, you know, World War II, everybody did their part. Whether you were a farmer who was in the Navy or you were a five-star general, the whole country was involved in that war effort. I think it just shows how everybody participated in the waging of that war.
You come from a big family, Bob.
Yes, I'm the third oldest of nine children myself. So, those were the days when big families were in vogue. And my oldest brother was a draftee who was sent to Vietnam, and he was a helicopter crew chief, was wounded twice within the span of 10 days, has two Purple Hearts and some other decorations from that bloody conflict. So I also dedicated a chapter to him, and he has the same name as my father. So there was a senior and junior who were both war veterans, and myself, an Army veteran who went to war to write about it.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about that a little bit, because, most folks would not be familiar with just how that happened. Maybe their even limited familiarity with it would be from war movies, where we sometimes saw a correspondent.
Yes, and, you don't see, you know, who's out there now, who's out there living with the grunts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell you, my Army experience, I was... everybody had a draft number according to their birthday during selective service. And I haven't had the last number ever called and the last draft ever held. So you can call me lucky. So in 1990, I was just working at my job in New York City with the Associated Press, and the boss came by and said, I want you to go cover the war. And there I was off on the first flight I could get. And at the time, the Pentagon and the news executives, in their infinite wisdom, had decided, well, there's going to be so many reporters here, we can't take them all out into the field. So we'll just take a select number, a pool of reporters, and then they can file their stories, ship them back, and everybody else can use their information, their stories, and file their own information. So I got selected to Army Combat Pool Number 1, which happened to be assigned to the 82nd Airborne. And once again, my luck was just spot on.
There's a picture of you in the book banging away at your typewriter. It looks like, I can't quite tell from the picture, but obviously in combat conditions. I don't know, it looks like you're in the back of a truck or something with your typewriter on a wooden case or something like that.
It's the back of a Humvee, a dusty desert Humvee, and you'd perch it up on anything you could. Now, that's a manual typewriter filing stories on a war fought in really the dawn of the digital age. So I called it my Combat Olivetti typewriter because I still have it, by the way. I kept it. I don't know why. I don't have a ribbon for it, but I kept it.
It's hard for me to believe, and then I was just kind of trying to do the math in my head, which is not easy for me, and you were in the Gulf War. Gosh, that's 25 years ago now, isn't it? Gosh.
26, yeah. Wow. Yeah, and just had, I was just down in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, home of the Airborne, and it was All-American Week, and reunited with some of my Airborne infantry people I was in the war with, and, there are guys with wings on their chests and combat infantry badges who call me brother because I went out there with them and wrote down their names and hometowns and what they were feeling about that war. So there's a bond that forms even to this day. If you're a war correspondent out there with the people, they remember you. I remember them. This book is a tribute to the men and women in uniform who fight for this country.
Well, I was never in combat, but I feel a little bit of kinship with you, Bob, I got to tell you, because my father was in the 82nd Airborne in World War II. He was one of the All-Americans.
Where did he jump? Did he ever say?
He jumped into Normandy 2 o'clock in the morning on 6 June 1944, 4 hours before they hit the beaches at Omaha and Utah. He jumped behind the enemy lines.
Jump out of a perfectly good airplane in the middle of night
behind
German lines with a rifle and all you could, and what you're going to eat for the next, what, it was 33 days at that Normandy campaign.
Yeah.
Listen, those guys are larger than life. If you jump into combat with the 82nd Airborne, you get a little gold thread on your wings. They call it a mustard splat, and that doesn't sound very much. But listen, I salute your dad for... And I have a kinship with him, absolutely. I feel like he was one of my older brothers.
There's a couple of other pictures. By the way, listeners, if you've joined us a few minutes late, welcome, gosh. We're talking with Bob Dvorak, author of Drive On. Where's your book available, by the way, before I forget, Bob?
You can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. I have a Facebook page called Drive On. People contact me. I can ship you out a personalized copy of it.
His book, Drive On, subtitled The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. There's another picture here. First of all, and I'm not sure, is that your dad or you? It looks like you're being interviewed on a TV show or something.
Oh, that's me. That was down in All-American Week was in May, where anybody who was ever in the 82nd is invited back. And this is the 100th anniversary of the division. Now, they went airborne 75 years ago, but they actually formed in World War One. And they call them the All-Americans because somebody figured out in their ranks there were guys that from every state in the Union at the time. So All-Americans might seem like a sports term, but in the Army, that double-A patch is 82nd. One of the most recognizable military units in the world. And yeah, I was interviewed in one of the Fayetteville stations before All American Week to talk about the book, but really to talk about the airborne and to a wonderful history, a century of service.
Mm-hmm. So your father came back home after World War II. Did he come back to Uniontown? Is that where you were born?
Yes, and you know, some guys came back and used their money to buy, you know, Harley Davidson and ride across the country or whatever else. He used his status as a returning war veteran to purchase a Farmall H-Series tractor, which meant that on the family farm they didn't have to use plow horses anymore. They went to a motorized tractor, so that's how big a deal it was for him. But, yeah, he came home, married my mom in 47, had nine kids of his own, so he contributed nine kids to the baby boom. And, you know, those guys never talked about it. It wasn't like it was, you know, nobody called him the greatest generation at the time. And he would have kind of, I think he would have kind of laughed at that. I was doing my job. I did what I had to do. They didn't talk about it. They didn't complain. Just came home and wanted to live their lives in peace. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen because only the dead know the end of war.
There's a photograph of your father, in his Navy uniform. He looks like he's still in high school, like he's about 15 or 16 years old.
Dave, that's interesting. He left high school early, and at the time, if you were leaving to join the service, you could leave school early, and they gave you an early diploma. So he does have a high school diploma, but he left before he graduated with his class because he was going off to serve his country.
Mm-hmm. They were all young. Well, almost all of them were
young.
Yeah,
they're baby faces,
yeah,
aren't they? Look at
them.
I mean, it's incredible.
My dad was 19. He had just turned 19 when he enlisted in the 82nd Airborne. Went to Camp Blanding, Camp McCall, and then trooper school down in Georgia.
Yeah, Benning.
Benning.
And, well, of course, those guys did it for the jump pay. You got an extra $55 a month for being able to jump behind enemy lines. Did he ever tell you about the physical test required to become an 82nd Airborne paratrooper?
He fortunately, for many years, didn't talk about it, which was pretty common. But fortunately, several years before his death, we were able to sit down, and in fact, for many nights, and I was able to not only hear his story, but write it for the rest of the family. So.
Oh, is that right? So
yeah,
you have,
yeah.
You know, and doesn't that make you feel closer to him now because you own that story?
Especially on Father's Day weekend, as I'm sure it does for your father, who's also passed away, right?
That's correct. Passed away in 1977 of a massive heart attack, and I still believe that he was fighting kamikazes to the day he died, you know, those flashbacks.
I love one of the quotes you have from your dad, and I'm just picking and choosing here, obviously, interest of time, but talking about his fellow soldiers in World War II, he said, they wanted to die for their country. I wanted to live for mine.
Right. He was talking about the Japanese suicide bombers, you know, who're going to die for their country. He said, look, hey, I want to live for mine. But, you know, when they said, well, we're having this new service called the Airborne Branch. What kind of physical requirements do we want in a man who's willing to jump out of an airplane at night with his own rifle to fight behind enemy lines for however long? And they said, well, they lined up a doctor on his right ear and a doctor on his left ear. They looked through the canal and could see each other. They said, you're good to go. They were always a little, it's true to this day. And, of course, I have to plead guilty to that myself because I was right there with them.
Took a lot of courage to jump off those 300-foot towers down there in Georgia. As my father said, he said a lot of guys washed out when it came time to do that.
Oh, yeah, and remember at the time, they were just wearing plastic football helmets and, you know, and these flimsy chutes. It was all new. They were making it up as they went along. And I have absolutely the highest, utmost respect for your father and anybody else who served in that magnificent organization. What a great legacy that they have served the American people for 100 years, never let the public down, and never will. I mean, that's they're high-speed people.
And I share the respect for your late father and his pitching in. Of course, he was in the Pacific Theater as opposed to the European, but that's where the Japanese kamikazes were fanatics. And then, of course, his last port of call at Hiroshima after the bombing there. Wow. I have to ask you, as we're starting to run out of time here, Bob, but you mentioned that you were a writer, war correspondent. Your father kept a pictorial journal. I thought that the Navy prohibited the carrying of cameras during the war. How did your dad get these pictures, Bob?
Absolutely. It was such a stringent violation. These guys risked jail terms if they carried cameras, because they didn't. This was all supposed to be top secret. He had money for the first time in his life, bought a camera, and he tucked it into his sock. He smuggled it on board ship. I mean, this is all, you know, against regulations, but like he would say now, what are they going to do, send me back to Hiroshima? As a youngster, and you would appreciate this, when you're 19 years old and you're seeing the world for the first time, you want to have some record of it. You want to, you know, just leave. And I guess, and he kept all these pictures in, of all things, a lingerie box, and it was kept in the closet in the attic. You know, you open it up, and it's like a time machine. So I think I'm going to do something more with it and just publish everything that he took, because it's the story of all wars.
Wonderful to chat with you, especially at the time of Father's Day. And we're talking, folks, to one particular chapter in Bob's book, talking about the story of his dad, his father, during World War II. The title of Bob's book is Drive On, The Uncensored War of Bedouin Bob and the All-Americans. And there's a picture of a Humvee on the cover, and it looks like it's decked out to go into the desert for about 90 months. I don't know, you got everything and his mother packed on there.
You know, that was my Humvee, and it was in the middle of the Euphrates Valley, and you carry everything you're going to need. Yeah. And if you look at that sleeping hole in the foreground, that's mine. The Army teaches you, to dig a hole wide enough, long enough, deep enough to get in out of the wind, so you have a little protection. You stack all the dirt on the side facing the enemy, so if a shell comes in, that dirt wall might absorb some shrapnel. If the shell hits directly, there's nothing they can do, however, but all they have to do is shovel the dirt back on top of you because you dug your own grave. That's how efficient Uncle Sugar gets.
Not only have I never heard that story before, I've obviously never seen a photograph of it. Drive On, available. By the way, if you're looking for Bob online, it's Dvorchak, Dvorchak. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Bob.
You are, and my drill sergeant in the Army called me Alphabets because he could never pronounce that one.
The title of his book is Drive On. Hey, if you're ever back in the Pittsburgh area, I wouldn't mind shaking hands, Bob.
Well, I live in Penn Hills, so I have a daughter who lives up in Cranberry, Mars, and I'm fascinated to have heard your father's story, and wish you the best for Father's Day too.
I'll be in touch. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
At Butler Health System, there's more to medicine than the most advanced tools and techniques. There's the dedication to providing the most personal care, one that's shared by every member of our team, like renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Horowitz.
I came to Butler because I wanted to practice medicine the way it's supposed to be done. It's truly about the patient. We get to know the people and what's important to them.
That dedication is why Butler Health System is trusted by our neighbors across the region and chosen by exceptional doctors who share our philosophy that the patient comes first, like orthopedic surgeon Charles Spingola.
I knew I'd have the tools and technology, but I also knew that there was a real commitment to genuine care. We don't treat medicine like an assembly line.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care, but more importantly, we know why we have to. caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Going to be talking, listeners, about, well, I dare say, an individual that perhaps you've not heard of, or maybe you've heard of him, but don't know much about him. Our guest visiting with us by telephone on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey. We chat for the next few minutes with Maurice Dorsey. Mr. Dorsey, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Well, good morning. Yes, Dave, it's nice for you to have me on the show today. I appreciate it very much.
The gentleman that I was referring to is Henry G. Parks, Jr., who was an incredibly successful businessman who had to struggle against racial bigotry for his entire life. Do you think I'm correct, Maurice, in characterizing Mr. Parks as someone that most of our listeners would probably not know too much about?
Well, actually, I think so, because Mr. Parks started his business in 1951, and a number of the listeners would probably be my age, but I think some who are listening probably do remember him, because the state of Pennsylvania was very supportive of Henry Parks and his pork sausage business, and Philadelphia especially, and the First Pennsylvania Bank had hired him to serve on their board. So maybe the listeners will know about him.
Well, maybe if I mentioned the slogan that he used for his company,
yes,
the Parks Sausage,
yes,
Company, maybe that will have some of our listeners going, oh, yes, I remember that. The slogan was, more Parks sausages, Mom, please. And
yes,
we saw that on thousands of TV commercials, didn't we?
That's right. Yeah, and radio, TV and radio and billboards all over New York and Philadelphia and throughout the state of Pennsylvania. Yes, but the advertisement, he had hired an advertising executive, Leon Schaefer Golnick from Baltimore, to develop that. And the original ad was Moore Park Sausage's Mom. The please wasn't added until 2 years later, because Henry was marketing to children, he which I thought was a very ingenious method of getting his name out to young children, because the children would ask their mother when they heard this jingle, because the jingle was sort of announced by a very young child, you know, their age, around 9 or 10 years old, the son of a radio producer. And so when the kids came home from school and said, Mom, Moore Park Sausage's Mom, the female consumer groups created a request to Henry to say, tell these children to say please. You know, I want, you know, I don't mind giving them your sausage, but tell them to say please. Don't, you know. So they added please. It was Moore Park Sausage's Mom, please. And so the please was added later, which I thought was really very, very, very good.
I wanted to ask Maurice about the title that you chose for your biography of Henry G. Parks, Jr., and for listeners, the title is Businessman First. Why did you use that title?
I used that title because Henry was very actively engaged in the neighborhood and community of where he lived. He was involved not only in the NAACP and the Urban League and the United Negro College Fund as a form of giving back to the community. I mean, he was making profits in his business. He became one of the wealthiest African-American businessmen in the country at that time. But he was also elected to the Baltimore City Council in a jurisdiction where there were predominantly black people or people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And they were considering him to be the next mayor of Baltimore City. And so when I interviewed Henry and asked him if he would consider doing that, he looked at me and he said, Maurice, man, I'm a businessman first, you know. So I figured his priorities, with all of his engagement with all of the community organizations and, you know, his work with the Baltimore City government and the state of Maryland, and actually he spoke before Congress for small business organizations, he felt that his goal, his mission, his vision, his idea was to be a businessman, and that's what he wanted to do. He did not want to be mayor of Baltimore City.
We're talking about the late Henry G. Parks, Jr., who was born in 1916, died in 1989. Extremely successful businessman, one of the wealthiest African Americans in the country of his time. His company was Parks Sausage Company, based in Baltimore, but expanded all over the country. But even during the 50s and the 60s, Maurice Dorsey, this highly successful businessman, had to overcome hatred, resistance. I understand one of his plants in the southern part of the country was burned to the ground by the KKK.
Yes, that's correct. Henry's original plan, and I really should call him Mr. Parks, but Henry's original plan was to create this product and sell it to the southern states, because southern people were doing more laborious kinds of work, and they ate more hearty types of foods, whereas wealthy people and people in the north, who in New York and Philadelphia, who were making more money, you know, were more weight conscious, so they weren't eating scrapple and sausage and those kinds of foods. But when the Ku Klux Klan burned down his plant, rather than Henry being very negative, he took that setback and reversed his market and went from Virginia to New York to Delaware, Boston, and the eastern seaboard north, but his original intent was to go south. So I think, you know, his sense of having a positive attitude toward adversity sort of helped him in mobilizing the business.
Today, there will be especially younger people who might find it hard to believe that he had to fight such racial hatred in the 50s and 60s, but this was before the civil rights era. And for goodness sakes, Major League Baseball was not integrated until the late 1940s.
That's correct.
The United States Army during World War II, the United States military
yes.
during World War II was still segregated.
Absolutely. My dad was in that, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, wow. We might want to pat ourselves on the back, you know, about how sophisticated we are today, but it wasn't all that long ago when we were living
yes.
in a very segregated nation here in the U.S.
Absolutely. And I was all, and that was one of the commonalities that Henry and I had together, because he went to segregated schools in his primary schools, and when he went to secondary school at Roosevelt High School in Dayton, Ohio, even though the academic programs were integrated, the programs, the extracurricular programs, were not integrated. There were separate activities for both black and white students.
Hmm.
And
starting to get a lot of breakup in your signal, Maurice. Are you still there?
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
I am still here.
Okay, we're getting a lot of breakup on your signal there for a moment or so, but it sounds good again now.
Okay.
Maurice Dorsey attended Ohio State University, had a pretty famous roommate while he was there, didn't he, Maurice?
Yes, Jesse Owens was his roommate. They lived in a boarding house off campus. Hal was not integrated at that time at Ohio State for Henry.
You yourself, as you said, you were the only African-American student in your high school class. You went on, you've got a couple of master's degrees, a Ph.D. You're retired now from the federal government. Is his business still operate under the name of Parks Sausage Company, or has it been sold, or what?
Yes, it has been sold. He sold it prior to his death. It was sold to the Noren Corporation after his after he had issued stock. He had an expansion problem. He needed to build more, and blacks weren't able to get money for expansion projects in Baltimore as they could in some places. But it was the First Pennsylvania Bank who actually gave him money and included him on his board at one point, but he did sell it before he died. The company still exists in Baltimore today, but it's under a different management system, and it certainly is not the dynamic company that it was when Mr. Parks was alive.
Our time is just about gone, Maurice Dorsey. Can you tell us what we can learn from the life of Henry G. Parks?
Yes. The upshot of the entire book is, through adversity, setbacks, segregation, oppression, women's rights, physical handicap, it's any category where a person feels oppressed, this book indicates that you can still make it. You strive, you can achieve, you can do great things in your neighborhoods, in your communities, you can help people, you can give back, and you can improve the quality of your life. Henry Parks was an example of the kind of man who could do that, and he built relationships between the black community and the white community at a very difficult time in U.S. history. And I would like to conclude by saying my book is available at my website, www.mauricewdorsey.com, and it's also available at amazon.com, and it's available electronically, paperback, and hardback.
Thank you very much, Maurice. Nice to talk to you today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Sure, sure. So long. Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 00. The pick 3 is 818. The pick 4 is 4393. The pick 5 is 68376. Wild ball for each of